This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, the sparks that ignite hate, the growth of American extremism with Chip Barlay, investigative reporter, independent scholar, and progressive activist specializing in the study of U.S. right-wing movement.
What happened at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin? Hate crime? Act of domestic terrorism? And what's feeding white supremacist radicalization? Chip Berlay, investigative reporter, independent scholar, and progressive activist specializing in the study of U.S. right-wing movements, joins us. He's written scholarly articles on conspiracies, theories, religious, apocalyptic aggression, and organizations of racist groups. Berlay examines major terrorist plots and racist rampages that have emerged from the American radical right and in the context of mass media's vilification of scapegoated groups.
He looks at governmental policing and military policies and the politics of race and gender hierarchies that stimulate individual and group aggression. Berlay is here to remind us that whether the lone wolf or leaderless resistance cells on the radical right, they can be likened to the mind canaries, warning us of something toxic spreading with fumes of anxiety throughout our society. Now the sparks that ignite hate, the growth of American extremism. Chip Berlay, thanks for joining us.
Sorry,
good evening.
Such a tragic moment.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's begin with that most recent and most dramatic of the tragic moments. How are we to understand this, given the facts that we know about an individual white supremacist neo-Nazi self-defined, or I'm not so sure he was self-defined, but certainly the society now has defined him as such. How do we understand this conflagration?
Well, he was in fact a member or a person who participated in neo-Nazi activities with skinheads who were racist. Not all skinheads are racist, it's important to mention, and with a kind of hate music or hate rock. People have been confusing it with punk or heavy metal, which, again, it's there's been very bad reporting. So he was an active participant, which means he's actually, it was not a form of leaderless resistance, and he's actually not a lone wolf. The definition of the government for a lone wolf is someone who has never been involved in an organized insurgent or race hate group. So what we have is a political soldier, a person who ideologically was fed up with people of color polluting America, who was involved in a number of bands that talked about getting rid of the mud people and the Jews. And this is the classic neo-Nazi rhetoric in the United States.
Now, I want to contextualize that in terms of there's generally documentation by the Southern Poverty Law Center, among others, of the proliferation, the growth of right-wing extremism with as its cornerstone a supremacist base. How factual is that, or what are we talking about in America now with the growth of supremacist thought groups?
Well, I think we need to call them what they are. This is a white racist movement, and it also indicts Jews as plotting with inferior people of color to destroy America. So right now there's been an expansion in the more populist patriot movement. You have a very large Tea Party movement. I want to make it clear I'm not comparing the two and saying they're the same. But when you have a very large right-wing movement that sort of in between the mainstream political party of the Republicans and the ultra-right, who are insurgent and really want to overthrow the government and replace it with a racially conscious and Jewish-free nation-state, it can create frustration and a sense that they're losing the battle, and individuals in the neo-Nazi movement, the white supremacist movement, step forward and engage in this hero complex where they decide to take action and engage in what's called propaganda of the deed. It happens on both the left and right, but it seldom works in terms of fomenting a revolution, but it's very common in that kind of mindset.
Well, it seems to be happening from the right, though. How does right-wing media play into this?
Well, the right-wing media stretches from Fox News on your television cable station every night to a whole range of online and radio programs, internet sites, publications that are in print, and music venues where hate music is played. So there's a whole venue here that delivers this information. And of course, if you're talking about the connection then between the vilification of a named scapegoat on which everything that's wrong with the nation, your community, and your life can be blamed, then there is a long scholarship going back even before the Nazi genocide that points out that if in a society you have this repetition of these bad people are out to get us, it begs the question, why don't we get them first?
I want to go back to that comment that Ken referenced, really, about the mind canaries warning us of something toxic, spreading the fumes of anxiety through our society. I have always thought that the power relationships that, again, white supremacist ideological thought and, indeed, gender bias are the cornerstones that build and feed on the perversions of and ultimate aggressions of right-wing attacks, whether it's burning down a mosque, which of course just happened again, whether or not it's the attack on the Sikh temple or numerous other instances that have proliferated within our society. Do you see it that way, and or other factors that are those noxious gases?
Well, look, we're a society that has been built historically on race, class, and gender hierarchies, and that's just easy to demonstrate through any kind of historical survey. And so if you have a society that is, from the get-go, built on hierarchies, unfair hierarchies of race, gender, and class, then anytime there's stress in the society and people feel they're losing their power dynamic and relationships, then that can create violent outbursts. There's a guy named McVeigh at Notre Dame who writes about how right-wing movements are really built around defending what people have in the middle against a perceived or real loss. And I think what we have now is, with the tremendous stress in the economy, is people trying to defend their racial and gender hierarchies as at least a way of maintaining some ability to stay afloat, even if it's just psychological. In the Colorado instance, you know, it's not clear exactly what happened. This is a person who clearly has some psychological problems, but there's a study, two things that people need to note. The people who have actual diagnosed mental illness are no more prone to violence than anyone else in the society. But people who have mental illness who act out in violence don't just pick random targets. They are also handling and massaging and being massaged by the culture in which they live and the stresses that they're under. And so there's different targets are picked with different ideas of protection of the idealized society. And so the superhero complex is generally on the right been employed in defense of these race, gender, and class hierarchies.
Is there a particular problem of this kind of activity being sort of, I don't want to say fostered, but does the military act as an incubator for it?
Well, if you're looking at the statistics, you'd have to argue that most people who join the military don't come home and shoot up Sikh temples or the Holocaust Memorial Museum. So what you have is, in the last 10 or 15 years, and about 15 years ago, I briefed Carol Mosley Brown from Illinois, the elected official, on the fact that the neo-Nazi movement in the United States was sending people into the military for military training so that they could become political soldiers when they got out. And this has been going on all along. The fact that not that long ago there was a government report that was leaked that talked about the fact that people returning from the military, some of them were likely to be recruited into the white supremacist movement. The right-wing media went ballistic and said, oh, this is a slur, but it's a sociological fact. the problem with that report was that it made no distinction in terms of ideas and actions, and so it was a civil liberties nightmare. But the idea that the right wing was training people through military participation to come back and be in white supremacist movements, that was true.
And I want to get into the immigrant groupings, diverse immigrant groupings that are in this country. Certainly the discussion of militarization of the border with Mexico can feed and has most decidedly a supremacist thought, etc. But I'm wondering at your own research and thoughts on how the various attacks on different immigrant groups necessarily fuel these movements. You know, we can certainly go back and look at the movements. The Klan still exists. There's Posse Comitatus and the Aryan Nation and the Christian Identity movements and the racist skinheads. And of course, you also reference in some of your work the Lyndon LaRouche fascist cult. But how do the sentiments or the economics of immigration feed and fuel ultra-right-wing aggression?
Well, historically, it's always been true that immigrant groups that are considered not like us are the target of all kinds of state action as well as paramilitary action. And you go back and look at the Palmer raids in 1919-1920, and that was at the swarthy-skinned Italians and Russians were all Bolsheviks or anarchists, and thousands were deported. And it turned out, of course, that most people who were deported had done nothing. And the man who signed the deportation papers, Lewis Post, wrote a book saying it had all been a delirium. So the targeting of immigrant groups, you look at the Chinese Exclusion Act, you look at the internment of the Japanese during World War II. Today you look at bizarre conspiracy theories about what Mexicans are up to and building a superhighway to Canada so drug rage, you know, Mexican truck drivers can kill our children. The stuff that you can read online is really hair-raising, but also you look at the major target, of course, in terms of right-wing media has been Muslims and Muslim Americans.
And Homeland Security, they seem to be focused on Muslims and Muslim Americans also. Are they beginning to look at white supremacist groups? I know there was a study a couple of years ago that they made, but didn't pull back from, and basically suppressed it.
Well, that was the study I was talking about earlier, which was suppressed, and it was absurd. I mean, the problem was a civil liberties problem, but the right wing was basically put forward a phony line that this somehow was besmirching the honor of our military heroes, when in fact what it was saying was a factual truth about how the neo-Nazi movement had been sending people into the military. So what happened was, because of political considerations, which is really quite astonishing and shocking, the fact that the largest targeting in the United States of violence against targeted groups is against immigrants and people of color and Muslims by right-wingers, not by Muslims at all.
You know, one of the things that continues to disturb me, I feel that we've certainly moved back in actual benefit and accomplishment in history, really probably two decades, when it comes to the issue of there was a real empowerment movement, an empowerment movement of that was spurred most dramatically by the people of African ancestry, which was then picked up on by so many other groups, Latino groups, indigenous people, indeed the women's movement, the gay movement, et cetera, et cetera. Now, at this juncture, there are so many ways and desires to take that back. We're witnessing, for example, massive voter suppression happening throughout the country. So I'm interested in whether there is a deliberacy. And we're not just talking about the lone individual or even the cells that exist of various neo-Nazis, et cetera, but really the kind of government policy public officials who seek to kindle supremacist thought, issues of harassment and discrimination and prejudice to continue to accomplish their own empowerment. And that's really what's inculcating the social cultural fabric and breeding the extremists to act out on, again, supremacist, racist thought.
Well, it's a dynamic, and, you know, I always urge people to try not to use the word extremist when talking about white racism or homophobia or sexism. These are words that have meaning, whereas extremist was developed to label Martin Luther King Jr. as a troublemaker. So what we have for throughout American history is this centrist notion that people who step too far out of line to the left or to the right are extremists and they're dangerous. And what we really have is a nation, again, built on these hierarchies, so you have the state enforcing these hierarchies through unchallenged structures and institutions. You have political parties, not just the Republicans, but primarily enforcing these hierarchies. You have the Tea Party, a populist movement of the right, riddled with racism by every demographic study that's been done. They're much more racist and anti-immigrant and anti-gay and certainly anti-abortion than the background demographic of even Republican voters. So, and then you have the ultra-right insurgent revolutionaries. All of them are involved in enforcing these unfair hierarchies. They just use different tools.
Well, just maybe also to follow through on another thread of that, I look at the policies in New York, for example, of stop and frisk, wherein last year there were close to 700,000 individuals, mostly of African ancestry and Latino, generally youth, who were stopped and frisked. 1%, I think there was like 6% of all those who were stopped were actually arrested. So, I mean, the rationalizations are for the stop and frisk are fraudulent, but they would seem to me to be indicative of the criminalization of a population and perhaps one of the greatest manifestations, certainly in New York at this juncture, of a racist behavior from the state. So how are we to understand that kind of supremacist, white supremacist, racist policy?
Well, there's two dynamics that very clearly are at play. One is the changing demographics of American society so that white people, quote unquote, will be a minority at some point, you know, in the next few decades. And this terrifies a lot of white folks. And the other thing is that with the liberation movements, and we're talking, you know, about the liberation movements of the African-American community, other people of color, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, all of these movements were about liberation and demanding full equality. Well, there were people who not only didn't like that, but they were scared by the demand for economic fairness. And so that's when Nixon appoints Lewis Powell to the Supreme Court, a person, Powell, who had written a memo saying that capitalism needed to defend itself and that companies had to spend money to fight back against these outlandish demands for economic fairness. So you have two movements that have been breeding since the liberation movements and the demands for economic fairness by groups like the Students for a Democratic Society and the labor union movement of the 60s. There have been two major movements to roll back the gains of equality based on identity and ethnicity, and another movement to roll back any attempt to equalize the economic system led by the Republicans but endorsed by many of the Democrats as well.
And how does the attack on the Dr. George Tiller over the abortion issue a few years back, and also Gabrielle Gifford, how does that fit into this?
With the Gifford attack, it's pretty clear that we're talking about a person who's emotionally disturbed but also picked a target after visiting right-wing websites and right-wing chat rooms where there clearly was a demonization of elected officials, and Gifford specifically was seen as a liberal in her state, accurately, I might add. The other stuff that's going on is built around the fact that the Christian right is still a major force in America. It's essentially taken over the Tea Party, so that one book just came out on the Tea Evangelists. And that was a political operation, essentially by a political soldier, to eliminate a person he saw as murdering human beings. And fetuses are not human beings, but if you're a Christian right activist and you're told that if abortion is murder, then act like it, he did.
Well, perhaps the fundamental question now for people who are activists and people who are of goodwill is, was the attack on the Sikh temple, was that preventable? And how can it be if one seeks to assure a process of working towards egalitarianism and actually a realization of the promise, but certainly not the actuality of America?
Given the activity of the alleged perpetrator who attacked the Sikh temple, it's unlikely, outside of a police state, that this individual could have been stopped. It's very difficult to stop someone who just gets up one day and decides to buy a lot of weapons and go out and kill people. There is a balance here that's very difficult. We need to be very sensitive to the civil liberties erosion that's gone on in this country since 9/11. But we also need to be well aware that as the economy continues to be stressed, and as the racial demographics continue to change, and as gender equality is demanded, there are going to be people who snap, either psychologically or politically, more so politically, by the actual statistical count of the attacks over the last few years. And so we need to talk about this. We need to demand civil liberties and equality, and we need to have the back of people who are the scapegoats. Up on my website, Research for Progress, there's a list of more resources. There's a horrifying list put together most recently by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but prior to that, Sarah Robinson and David Nybert and I were compiling the list of how many right-wing attacks have led to violence and attempted violence and death, and it's appalling. There is a murder spree against people of color and immigrants in this country by right-wing militants, and the government is pretending it's not happening.
And to follow through on some of your research and work, tell us again the major places that we can access your work, which I've got tons of the articles, and I find them really deep in their understanding of the American culture, of social and economic policy, and chock full of information that should provide us with the mechanisms for really addressing supremacist thought, policy, and action as it presents itself in this society. So, Chip, where do we go?
Well, I've been compiling the most recent information on Colorado and the Sikh temple and the torturing of the mosque at Research for Progress. And then, of course, there's a lot of other resources. I recommend Political Research Associates' website, publiceye.org. I like the demographic and statistical work of the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's quite accurate in the last 5 or 10 years. And, just keep involved in places like Alternet also carry a lot of good information.
Well, we need to have you back much more frequently to discuss these things in even further depth. Chip Berlay, thank you for your decades of activism, of research, and informing the body politic about these terrifying instances of aggression towards the populace, towards immigrants, towards women, towards people of color. We've got a lot of work to do. Definitely come back and speak to us more.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your work, and you're right. We're all in this together.
And we have been speaking with Chip Berlay.
America, we have been given a bad check. A check that has come back labeled insufficient funds. We cannot believe that there are no funds in this mighty vault of opportunity. In this great nation, this great country that we call America. So we have come to cash a check.
You
which will give us on demand the riches of equality and security and justice for all.
Listen to me, people, I got a story to say about the injustices in the U.S. of A. The man who pat your back and then rob you blind, leave you strung out in the streets to die. You got to stand up, join hands.
We need to stand up, America. We need to stand together because of the right of communication and leadership. We have lost trust and faith.
There's so much going on, it makes me wonder why the one who sent him to sit back and deny. War and poverty are at an all-time high, while our Mother Earth rapidly dies. Stand up, join hands.
If we could only come together,
stand up, join hands.
That have been long overpassed, overlooked, and not done. We need to stand up, join hands.
Stand up, join hands,
and make a stand.
You got to stand up, join hands, unite and make a stand.
Now the time has come for us as Americans to stand together. Time has come for us to have a true meaning in life.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.